I'm going to read something to you here for a second. And I just thought this was very interesting. It's going to tie into what I'm going to talk about. This was written about, I guess, 3 years ago. And it was published in Crisis Magazine. It's a Catholic publication. This is a Catholic writing this. It's called The Fun of Fear by Dan Lord. He said, "Is it good to feel scared? To not feel scared isn't an option. We may wish to ignore scary things, but we can't, not completely. Christians are not excluded from this rule. Be not afraid is an exhortation, not a magic spell. In fact, our Lord gives, well, I'm not going to read all he says. He talks about where he quotes Christ saying, 'Fear not them that kill the body, are not able to kill the soul, but rather fear him that can destroy both soul and body in hell.' And of course, we do have to have a proper fear of God, but I'm not advocating what this guy's saying here, by the way, what I'm going to read to you, lest you think I am when I get to it, but you'll see my point in just a second. He says, fear, therefore, is a tool. And the question is, can fear, used as a tool in the service of our own salvation be fun? I say yes. We often play with our fears in ways that can be beneficial to our souls by establishing a proper context for them, otherwise known as theater. This can take the form of scary movies, murder mysteries, ghost stories, any artistic enactment that, with our permission, presents to us something frightening within a clearly delineated milieu. Under such circumstances, we then have the power to grab hold of our fears, to manipulate them, even laugh at them. It diffuses fear's psychological and emotional hold over us." So I'm gonna skip a little bit, and here's his whole point. That's why I love Halloween. I believe Halloween is good. Not the way some people celebrate it today as a borderline satanic ritual or a dive bomb into the depths of depravity, but in the way it has traditionally been celebrated in this country. A game designed to give the players a shiver with a few sweets thrown into the bargain. Because all of us, and especially little children, carry around so many fears, large and small, about everything from death to how the rent will be paid this month, to a sudden crack in the earth opening and swallowing us up, Halloween gives us a raucous stage for the free expression of our anxieties. It can serve as a dramatic, coordinated, and altogether delightful way to explore and express Catholic doctrines like hell, the devil, purgatory, and sin. Some people worry about the idea of dressing up as scary things, but we are scary things. We are substantial. We are substantially good because we're made by God, but then we all proceed to disfigure that goodness by our sins, making our spirits ugly. Halloween gives us a creative, theatrical way to express this. We are made ugly by sin and become participators with evil, consigned to a kind of purgatorial state. We go from house to house, receiving the grace of God that will purify us, symbolized by treats. We bring the treats home, take off our masks, and enjoy the taste of heaven.
Wow.
So, he says, maybe you don't buy any of this. Maybe you're bothered by Halloween's pagan connections, which I don't believe warrant any more concern than the pagan connections to Christmas trees. Heck, he says, maybe Halloween just isn't your thing. I know some people have had bad experiences with Halloween. I have too. But I don't like throwing the baby out with the bathwater. We must remain on guard against evil, certainly, but we must also never give in to superstition. But he says this year they're gonna do all the fun Halloween stuff, and we'll jump at shadows in the canned witch laughter coming from the speakers hidden in a neighbor's azalea bush. We'll enjoy this little bit of controlled fear and let it work its strange magic. And when we go to Mass for All Saints Day the morning after, I'll thank God for all the gifts he gives us, including a healthy sense of fear." You know, that's very interesting to me. I like to turn over to 1 John 4:18. 1 John 4:18. By the way, what I want to talk about today is, let's look at the background of this holiday and give some consideration to what Christians ought to think about this holiday of Halloween. And it's coming up Thursday night. You know, we'll all be prisoners in our own home. And it's just a lovely time. But I want to read this in 1 John 4:18 in response to what we were just reading. It says here, there is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear. Because fear involves torment. But he who fears has not been made perfect in love. I mean, fear is not something we want to have. Now, of course, we do have to have a proper fear and a sense of a respect and a concern about what might happen to us if we go the wrong way in our relationship with God. We have to have a proper fear of that. But everything else, our goal is not to strive to be frightened. We want to live this life boldly and not be fearful. That's not to say it's never, people don't have fun every once in a while being startled or something, but I mean, the way that this holiday, I mean, for could be terrifying. Especially, I remember when I was a kid, there were things that were just horrible. Especially you go to some of these haunted houses. It was just awful. I mean, some of the things that go on there. But some people just eat it up. I mean, they love this. They live for that. And it's really disturbing because that is not to be our goal. Our goal is not to be subject to the spirits and all this realm around us, but to be confident and bold in going through our lives and in facing the darkness. You know, 2 Timothy 1:7, I'll just quote, says, God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. You know, as we're just hearing about, we are to have, sound mindedness and wisdom and thinking logically about things and not just being subject to these kind of disturbances. Anyway, there's a lot to think about in this regard. I found it very interesting. This was not about this particularly, but I thought this was very interesting. Just a little story. This is from Let Me Illustrate. It's a collection of anecdotes compiled by Donald Gray Barnhouse. And in here, he's got a little story about the hunter and the bear. Maybe you've heard this. But it says, as the hunter raised his rifle, the bear called out, "Can't we talk this over like two sober human beings?" The hunter lowered his gun. "What's to talk over?" he asked. "Well, for instance," said the bear, coming closer, "what do you want to shoot me for?" "Simple," grunted the hunter. "I want a fur coat." "Well, all I want is a good breakfast," smiled the bear. "I'm sure we can get together sensibly on this." So they sat down to work out an agreement. After a while, the bear got up all alone. They had reached a compromise. The bear had secured his breakfast, and the hunter had on his fur coat. And the point they make here is there has never been any other result in the warfare between the flesh and the spirit when the spirit permits any compromise with the flesh. Sin is deceitful and will always destroy, even while putting forth a pretense of fair words. The word of God gives us the only possible course of action: flee. I think that's very good. But if you think about that in terms of these festivals of humanity that are in opposition to the ways of God, we think, you know, and I know we here understand this about Halloween, and but there have been many in the church that have actually said this is okay. I actually have been disturbed by people tell me, well, this is just completely secular. There's nothing about this that, you know, that is a problem now. We can do this. We'll look at this idea here in a little bit. Just to have some fun and all the, you know, the costumes and the, you know, what scary things and the candy. It's all good stuff. Candy is good stuff, by the way, but, probably not that great in quantity, but, I think we understand here that this is something we should not have anything to do with. But it's good to be reminded of why that is, especially because we encounter people that challenge us on these things. And they want to, you know, maybe convince us that there's nothing wrong with this. And we saw that a lot of people in our history in the church have been able to be convinced of things you never would have thought people would be convinced of. But they were. And so that's why it's good to be reminded of why we don't do this. And there's more to think about too. I want to give us some more perspective on this. And just again, as was mentioned in the sermonette, you know, to be ready to give an answer to anyone who asks us why we believe the things we do, why we believe as we do, and why we don't do certain things. It's important that we be able to do that. Well, it's not that hard to do that so much with something like Halloween as it is with, let's say, Christmas and these kind of things. Because Christmas, everybody thinks, well, we're worshiping God and it's all great and fine. Halloween, it seems really demonic just on its face. And a lot of people understand that. But then they go ahead and say, yeah, but we can do it and it's not a big deal. Or they'll say, well, we can do it if we dress the kids up like angels and saints and just Star Wars characters or something. And that's all okay because that has nothing to do with demonism. It's just having a costume party or doing kinds of fun things. But this is all rooted in something very dark. And that's what we need to understand. And can we go into this in any depth? We have to think about why we don't do this and why God tells us to avoid things like this. Let's look at some of the history of this festival. We've written about this a number of times in our publications, and I certainly would recommend that you go and look at some of the things that we've written on this. We have in our Holidays or Holy Days booklet, we have a section in here on Halloween, a celebration of evil, which it is. It's certainly a celebration of evil. That's because it's reveling in it, if you think about it. It's not just saying, well, we're just going to have fun. We're actually promoting. I don't want to say we're, because nobody who does this is going to say they're promoting evil things. Because they'll, but yet it desensitizes you to evil things to some degree. You know, they put these horrible shows up. I'm glad right now that they don't have this, but we used to drive, well, they have a billboard up out on 54. It's not as bad as ones that's been in past years. In past years, we've driven by and I've tried to, you know, talk to the kids or about, I'll hold something down on the floor so they're looking down at the time we drive by so that they're not looking at this horrible stuff that's out on the side of the road. I mean, it's just absolutely horrible. But you know, I mean, they'll have like people with gory scenes of chainsaws cutting through people's necks and this kind of awfulness. And you just think, why do you want to put that before your eyes? And the Bible actually says something about that. In fact, I'll have us turn to a verse on that in Psalms. This is a book of, this is in Psalm 103, or sorry, 101, I guess it is, Psalm 101, verse 3, says, I will set nothing wicked before my eyes. And that's what we're supposed to be dedicated to doing. So why do we want to put things like this before our eyes? It's absolutely horrifying, a lot of what is portrayed in this. And I'll give you another verse to think about in that regard, just the opposite. What are we to be thinking about? It's a verse, you know, we probably know, but it's good to be reminded of it. And that is in Philippians, the book of Philippians, chapter 4. Philippians, chapter 4. And find this in verse... I just passed it there myself. Philippians 4 verse 8 tells us, finally, brethren, whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there's any virtue, if there's anything praiseworthy, meditate on these things. This is what we're to fill our minds with. This is what we're to have in our perspective. This is what we're to be looking at. We're not just to be putting all this vileness before us, which it really is, because it just darkens our minds and gets us saturated with wrong things. And maybe one of the biggest problems, again, is it just numbs us to some of the evil. We should be shocked. But sadly, as we see more, we're not shocked. Now, some of that's unavoidable. It comes at us. And the world has that effect on us, and it's terrible. But we should not revel in that. That makes it even worse. We're going to just revel in this and, you know, well, we can't beat them, join them, so let's just have a good time, that kind of thing. That is a ludicrous idea when it comes to this stuff. Think about the bear again. I mean, this is not something we toy around with. We end up swallowed up by it. Just going through this a little bit, some of the history. This festival, this from the Encyclopedia of Religion says, Halloween or All Hallows Eve is a festival celebrated on 31st October, the evening prior to the Christian feast of All Saints Day. Now, let me explain that for just a second. You probably know this, but these aren't really two separate occasions. They're one occasion, because what you have is, and as it mentions here, that this comes from the Celtic Eve of Samhain. Actually, it's spelled what looks like Samhain, S-A-M-H-A-I-N. But the M-H is in Gaelic is pronounced more like an M without putting your lips together, so it comes out more like Samhain. And there's different ways that people do pronounce that. But it says, a celebration marking the beginning of winter as well as the first day of the new year within the ancient Celtic culture of the British Isles. The time of Samhain consisted of the eve of the feast and the day itself. And we can understand that quite well, because we understand that days are from even to even. They're from sunset to sunset. And actually, in ancient Celtic society, that's how they observed the days as well. It was from even to even, which makes sense. Why did they do that? Because we know who those people were anyway. They came from a biblical background. They were the children of Israel that had migrated to northwestern Europe. That's who the Celtic peoples were. But yet here they were doing this thing, which is not in the Bible. But I just want to make the point that they were keeping this observance that was from sunset to sunset. So it was the evening before and the day period. That was all considered one event. And so when you come into translating a lot of these things over into the early Christian, well, I don't want to say early Christian, a little bit later, when they were adopting paganism, some of the apostatizing Christians were adopting these pagan holidays. Again, this was something a lot of times that was not just the day, it was the evening before and the day. It was all considered one day. That's why you get, you know, Christmas Eve and Christmas, it's all considered one event. Same here, you ended up with a day that was originally on a different day, but I guess I think it was moved to this day in the 4th century, that you had the All Saints Day was moved to this particular day, November 1st. Now, All Saints Day, why is it called that? Because in the Catholic system, you had a day for every saint. You know, every major saint had like a day. But they get too many of those. Every day was some saint's day, and then there was too many, and they didn't have a way to have each of them have their own day. So they said, what we'll do is we'll just have this All Saints Day, so then we can have a day that catches everybody else that we can't fit for their own day. So we come up with this All Saints Day, which, again, was November 1st, and actually it was, if you think about it, as the evening and the morning, it's All Saints Eve and All Saints Day. And I say All Saints, saint is in the Latin language, you know, Santa is holy. In the Greek, it's Hagia is holy, but that's the same word as holy or hallows. That's why you get all, instead of All Saints, it becomes All Hallows. It's the same word in meaning, really it is. So All Hallows Eve, All Hallows Day, same as All Saints Eve, All Saints Day. That's where you get this this day. And All Hallows Eve, of course, is all, you know, Hallow Even, contracted to Halloween or Halloween. And that's where this name comes from. And the next day, by the way, in the Catholic calendar, also helps us to remember all the rest of the dead who aren't the saints, those who are in purgatory. It's All Souls Day on November 2nd, because you know, you want to remember all your dead loved ones, but you can't honor them as saints because you don't really know unless they've decreed it in the church. And then also, there's just an expectation that everybody except for the saints, I guess, have to go to purgatory for a while before they can be in heaven. So that's where everybody else is until they get purified enough to go to heaven. I mean, that's the theological system there that is in place. By the way, not everybody understands that, even in Catholicism. I mean, this is a strange sort of bag of doctrines that come up with all this. But that's not really the whole bad side of this. We think about these are false doctrines that have come out of paganism, all these things surrounding that. But what's at the root of this is they decided on a day to move this to. They moved it to this pagan festival that was in existence throughout Europe. This festival of Samhain. That's where they moved it to intentionally. And they were, you can find that in a number of encyclopedias where that is explicitly mentioned, that that's what was done, that they were moving it to this particular event. Now, another festival that took place at this time was a Roman festival as well. So you had the Celtic festival of Samhain. And by the way, that there's a lot to that Celtic festival that's dark. Again, what does it come from? I mean, apparently there's a sort of a celebration of the Lord of the Dead at that time. Now, some people deny that. They say, well, there's no such person as Samhain as the Lord of the Dead. But the issue, because they'll say, well, Samhain means, and it may, by the way, mean this in part, Sam is the word for summer in Gaelic, and Puin is the word for end. So they say it just means Sam Puin means summer's end. And so there's nothing wrong with that. It's just the end of summer and it's getting cooler, so we have this day. And it's also going into the cold time, which is when they say this is the Celtic New Year. But it does seem that there was this pagan god by the name of Samhain as well, or at least related terms, maybe Tamun is another version of that name, or Samhain, or even Shaman, and that these are also references to a pagan Lord of the Dead. There definitely was an idea of a Lord of Death, and an idea that the veil between our world and the spirit world was the thinnest at these in-between times. And this time is supposed to be the time in between the fall equinox and the winter solstice, and it comes right about in the middle. So is in these in-between times, the veil between the physical realm and the spirit realm is thinned out. And so there's a connection between the living and the dead, and between those alive on the earth and the spirits that walk the earth, and all of this kind of thing. So that's where you come up with some of these ideas about death and ghosts and so forth associated with this holiday. It goes way, way back. It goes way BC, a long time, several, many centuries before Jesus Christ, people had these ideas about this very time of year. It corresponded as well to the Beltane, which was in May. These are exactly 6 months apart. The May 1st on the pagan calendar is the Beltane on the Celtic pagan calendar. And it's supposed to talk about the beginning of the warm period, sort of the beginning of summer, and then you have the end of summer as this period here. And these are all these between times and the way they look at them, and that's why they want to celebrate those things or acknowledge them. From the Encyclopedia of Religion, talks about some of the customs. It says, divination activities remained a popular practice. Adults dressed in fantastic disguises and masks imitated supernatural beings and visited homes where occupants would offer tributes of food and drink to them. A fear of nocturnal creatures such as bats and owls persisted, since these animals were believed to communicate with the spirits of the dead. And by the way, I was reading elsewhere, it was talking about how they would have these big processions that came out of some of the ancient pagan processions on the various holy days. But these processions would go, you know, through the fields and so forth. And the farmers had to contribute to the procession or else they would get the trick. So it's trick or treat. You better give or bad things will happen to you from the spirits. I mean, this is, you have to appease the spirits. That's where the whole notion of trick or treat comes from, is the idea of appeasing the demons. You have to give them something or they'll give you something bad. You better look out. That's where that comes from. So then you had these adults that were parading around in masks pretending to be the demons so that they would not be the recipients of tricks and bad things happen to them, because they'd fool the demons into thinking they're with them. We're part of you guys, so you're not going to do anything to us. We're going to go help you do bad things to other people. And then it becomes just a thing that children would participate in. So when children are running around doing trick or treat, actually, if you think about it, what they're really doing is they're, and they don't know that they're doing this, I mean, obviously, but they're perpetuating an imitation of demonic spirits who are extorting treats or gifts what's the word I'm looking for? It's just their participation in these demonic activities. And so it's just remarkable to think about. That's what this is a continuation of. It doesn't seem like it is in one sense, because it seems maybe it's harmless fun that they're doing this. But that's what it really comes from. And that means something. It's not that we can say, well, they're not doing it because of that. Well, why are they doing it? In other words, and why are they doing it at this time? Why are they continuing it as this particular custom? It's not that they've invented a whole new custom. In fact, if you were to say, well, let's cut it out here and let's do it at some other time, I bet it just wouldn't be done. Because people would say, what's the point of that? They want to do it as this tradition that commemorates this thing going way back. That's very dark origins. Another aspect of this, you know, one of the customs you see is people bobbing for apples. And what's that all about? Well, evidently, this was a popular method of fortune telling at one time. People would bob their heads in to get the apple, and then they'd pull the peels off the apple, and whatever it would come to would tell them certain things about their fortune and these kind of things. But where does that go back to? Well, it goes back to the fact, as I mentioned a while ago, and I didn't get very far on mentioning it, but that this was also a Roman festival. The festival of the goddess Pomona, the apple goddess, was observed at this very time as well by the Romans. So you had, which I think about too, where does that whole fascination with the goddess of the apple come from? And in Latin, of course, the apple, the word for apple is mal, which mali, which is also the word for evil. Mal, that's where you get malice and maleficence and these kind of things. That there's a tie-in, and so the idea is this is like the evil fruit. And I think that goes all the way back to thinking that the fruit of the garden, of course, was the apple that was drawn from the tree. Not that it was, and we actually don't even believe that it was an apple that Eve pulled from the tree, but that in this sort of way that the traditions carry down, the apple is a symbol of that forbidden fruit. And so you have this, the embodiment of sin in that sense, and we're bobbing for that. Not that it's wrong to eat an apple. I don't want to say the wrong idea about that. But I'm just saying, as part of this whole custom and what it's going back to, we're basically dipping our heads in to draw out from the apple to see what our fortunes are going to be. You can see that, and it's tied to pagan gods and goddesses. This is very dark where this goes back to. It's not something that we should really have any association with, as we know from the scriptures. And we'll look at a few of those verses in a little bit to see that more clearly. But anyway, this is where this is all originating. And we've just got to, although there's another origination point to this as well, which Dr. Hosdell mentioned a little while ago, and I'll get to that in just a moment. I think that's something we need to know about as well. And I think it's quite disturbing when you realize what that's all about. But we had an article on Valentine's a few years ago. This actually it was last year, I guess January, February 2012. We revised the Valentine's article that we had. St. Valentine, Cupid, and Jesus Christ in the Good News. I'm going to read this to you because this directly bears on this idea that people have about why you can do Halloween. It says, but really what harm can there be in the celebration of lovers in the name of St. Valentine's? And, you know, again, they say, or you know, we want to change that to Halloween. Kids going out and getting candy and just having a good time out on the street. After all, what does it matter if some of the day's customs stem from pagan rites? God warned ancient Israel when he chose to the people he chose to represent true religion, not to mix pagan customs with worshiping him as the one true God. Let's look at this verse because it's in Deuteronomy 12. This is one that we always turn to with reference to Christmas and Easter and a lot of these days that have pagan customs in them. Deuteronomy 12. Excuse me. Deuteronomy 12. And we'll look at verses 29 through 31 here. This is what God told the Israelites when they came in the land, Deuteronomy 12, 29 through 31. And we can think about this in the sense of when the Catholic Church adopted this pagan festival of Samhain as All Saints Day, as a worship day for God. They actually adopted this as a worship day for God. So they were using this day as a worship day. And they were claiming that even the evening before and the reveling and all that was part of the, quote, worship of this day, even though there's nothing worshipful about that, unless you're worshiping not God, but something else. And that's what we understand this is really about. But it says here in verse 29, when the Lord your God cuts off from before you the nations which you go to dispossess and you displace them and dwell in their land, take heed to yourself that you're not ensnared to follow them after they are destroyed from before you, and that you do not inquire after their gods, saying, well, how did these nations serve their gods? I will also do likewise. In other words, what are the pagan customs? How did they worship? I want to worship like that. I want to worship the true God like that. And he says in verse 31, you shall not worship the Lord your God in that way, in the way that the pagans worship their gods. For every abomination to the Lord which he hates they have done to their gods. For they burn even their sons and daughters in the fire to their gods. I mean, that's, and somebody say, well, we're not doing that. Well, that's just the limit of what they do. That's not the only abomination. That's just the worst of it. But there's plenty of abominations that are not as bad as that they do. You're not to do any of that, God says. Whatever I command you, he says in verse 32, be careful to observe it. You shall not add to it, nor take away from it. Now, that doesn't mean we can't worship God in some way that is not ever specified in the Bible. I mean, we actually have examples of people instituting worship to God on maybe a day that hasn't been commanded per se. Purim, for instance, when the Jews did that. And even at the time of Hezekiah, you know, they observed days of unleavened bread for longer. I mean, these were things that were done at different times. And we have, like today, we have Thanksgiving, although some people say that has a bad origin, but I think Thanksgiving is okay for us to do. I don't believe it comes from paganism. But the key is you don't take things from paganism and use that as worshiping God. That's absolutely forbidden. In the New Testament, I want you to hold your place right here and turn over to 1 Corinthians 10. I'll just continue reading this here. In the New Testament, Paul compares mixing paganism with Christianity to worshiping demons. This is 1 Corinthians 10, verses 19 through 21. Paul says, what am I saying then? That an idol is anything, or what is offered to idols is anything? In other words, he was telling them you need to avoid this and avoid the appearance of being part of that. Rather, the things which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons and not to God. Now, there's a few other scriptures that show this in the Bible too, that you know, we think about, wait a minute. They're worshiping some false god. They're worshiping Zeus, the Greeks were. They're worshiping Apollo, or they're worshiping, in any of these pagan systems, they're worshiping some false god. Well, they say, well, that's just totally a false god. That's not a demon per se. But what Paul is saying here is that what's behind that is demonism. There are demons that are the authors of this false religious system. And in a way, the demons are posing as these false gods. And sometimes they do miracles of sorts, perform wonders, signs and wonders, and to convince people that their worship of these false gods is true. So in that way, when the people are sacrificing to these false gods, Paul's saying they really are sacrificing to demons and not to God. He says, and I do not want you to have fellowship with demons. Being part of their festivals, being part of the celebrations that they had, these pagan sacrifices and so forth. He says, you cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot partake of the Lord's table and the table of demons. You cannot do that, he's saying. That is absolutely wrong. Forbidden. And think of how unwise it is. This is how people want to live. They want to practice syncretism. They think they can worship God, even, with these false pagan customs. But God doesn't look at it that way. He never looks at it that way. He doesn't think, well, they're just worshiping me ignorantly. No, he considers that they're worshiping the false gods when they worship him with false customs that he has forbidden. It's an abomination to God, and that's not allowed. Holidays like St. Valentine's Day, this says, continually secularized into icons of Western culture, creating a caricature of religion. Most people couldn't care less if its origins are in the Roman Lupercalia, talking about Valentine's Day there, or early Christian doctrines that had nothing to do with the Bible. It's this very apathy about how to worship God and the corresponding moral decay that is the result of mixing Christianity with paganism. Even some Christians who reject religious holidays with roots in paganism, like Christmas and Easter, see nothing wrong with Valentine's Day, New Year's, Halloween, despite their pagan origin. The reasoning goes like this, and this is what we want to get in our minds, that we can never allow ourselves to think this way. The reasoning goes like this. Christmas and Easter must be rejected because they're attempts to worship God with pagan customs. That's true. The other holidays, however, like Valentine's, Halloween, New Year's, while they might have once been used to worship God, are now deemed completely secular. And since what God actually forbids is using pagan customs to worship him, we are free to practice pagan worship customs if they're not now used for worship. We're just having fun with it, along with the society. Yet this ignores the fact that God told the Israelites, I'd like to turn back over to Deuteronomy 12 where we just were, that God told the Israelites to completely eradicate all vestiges of pagan worship from their presence, not merely from their worship of him. Here where we just were in Deuteronomy 12, we read, just a second ago, we read verses 29 through 32, but I'd like us to look at the beginning of this chapter in verses 2 through 4, when God was telling them when they come into the land. He says, you shall utterly destroy all the places where the nations which you shall dispossess serve their gods, on the high mountains, on the hills, under every green tree. And you shall destroy their altars, break their sacred pillars, burn their wooden images with fire. You shall cut down the carved images of their gods, destroy their names from that place. You shall not worship the Lord your God with such things. But not only are you not to worship God with such things, you're just not to have those things there. They need to be eradicated. You should not have big, you know, scary Halloween decorations on your house. I mean, that is what this is saying. Maybe you're not using it for worship, but it doesn't matter because this stuff is supposed to be gone. All of these things that come from pagan worship. Now that doesn't mean everything pagans did, by the way. Pagans, ate food. We can eat food too. But pagan worship customs, whatever they did to worship their gods, that is not in the Bible. And because you might say, well, wait a minute, they had a harvest festival, so we can't have a harvest festival. Well, we do have a harvest festival because God commanded us to have one, the Feast of Tabernacles. So in having that, that's not the problem. Having a harvest festival is not the problem. But there are many things that they did and that are part of customs from paganism that are not things that God said to do. And those things are things that we must not incorporate into our lives in any way, whether worshipfully or just as something to have fun with. We're just not to do those things that come from pagan worship. They are a reminder to God of bad things. Even if we don't remember them, he does. He knows what happened. He saw all the bad things that were attached to these, including the sacrificing of children and horrible, horrible things beyond imagination that were part of the origin of these days. And here's another, fact though as well. Moreover, our whole life is to be one of worshiping and honoring God in all we do. The things we participate in should be seen in context of bringing glory to him. This doesn't mean we can have fun, for God wants us to enjoy life, but our fun is not to be independent of him. All that we think, say, and do should be to God's honor. You know, we're to worship God in spirit and in truth, and that's our whole life, not just when we come to church, not just whatever it might be. It's everything we do is to be part of that. And here's another fact, too. This is still a pagan worship day, even now. I got this from witchyway.net. Say, I don't recommend these, you know, websites, but this from this is a witch's website. witchyway.net/halloween.html. It says that Samhain, known most popularly as Halloween, marks the end of the third and final harvest, is a day to commune with and remember the dead, and is a celebration of the eternal cycle of reincarnation. Samhain, once again Halloween, is the most coveted Sabbat by the Wiccan and many pagan religions. In the European tradition, Samhain is the night when the old god dies, and the crone goddess mourns him deeply for the next 6 weeks. The popular image of her as the old Halloween hag menacingly stirring her cauldron comes from the Celtic belief that all dead souls return to her cauldron of life, death, and rebirth to await reincarnation. Halloween, plain and simple, is our favorite time of year. A true time for witches, witchcraft itself, and Wiccans alike who feel that on this night, the separation between the physical and spiritual realities is its least guarded and its veil the thinnest. It is a time for dimensional openings and workings. It is a somber holiday, one of the dark clothes and thoughts for the dead. It is said to be the time when those of necromantic talents, necromancy is the conjuring up of the dead, said to be the time when those of necromantic talents can speak with the dead, and it is certainly a time to remember one's own dead. Witches believe it is a time of endings, of relationships, and bad situations, and it is the time when one can see the glimmer of hope in the future. There are as many concepts attached to this holiday as any other, truly a time of remembrance of our ancestors and all those who have gone before. So that's my point here, is that this isn't some kind of dead ancient holiday that is not of honoring pagan gods way back, you know, among the Greek gods and that kind of thing. This is now. This is a pagan holiday that is being used now to worship pagan deities. And actually, in other witches, I've seen their comments have said, you know, when everybody's out doing Halloween, they're participating in our holiday, and we like that. Of course, it's a big holiday for the Church of Satan as well, which, you know, that's a whole nother thing. But it's their biggest holiday, in fact. And of course it is. It's Satan's big holiday. How could you, if you said, what's Satan's holiday? People who even, you know, are doing it are going to know that's what it is, because that is what it is. I want to get to another aspect of this. The New Year's concept about Halloween first seemed odd to me with regard to the identity of the Celts, because it fits the days, the idea of evening and morning that the Celts kept, but not the years. And in the Hebrew calendar, by the way, you have the Jewish New Year. Well, God said that the spring month of Nisan would be our first month on the Hebrew calendar. But actually, the Jews keep Rosh Hashanah, the Feast of Trumpets, as the first day of the civil year. That's the Jewish New Year. The Jewish New Year is trumpets. It's exactly 6 months apart from the beginning of the sacred year. So in the way this, you know, you basically end up having trumpets as a New Year celebration for those with, you know, who keep this calendar. But then we have the strange concept of, wait a minute, why are the Celts, if they're descendants from the Israelites, why are they keeping the New Year about a month later? And this was mentioned last week, I guess, by Dr. Halston briefly, but I'm going to go into this a little bit. And it's also odd to me that this festival, as well as the Beltane, did not seem to have a directly Babylonian or Middle Eastern pagan origin, like Christmas, Easter, although the idea of the apple part probably did. When and why did the Celts, who are the Israelites, come up with this? Well, you know, Brian and I were talking about this several years ago, and because he was, I think one time he was about to speak about Halloween. And we were giving some thought to this, and I really believe this is true. The story goes back to the time of Solomon, because he rebelled against God in supporting the paganism of his wives. God was going to hand the northern tribes over to one of Solomon's chief officers, Jeroboam. When Solomon got wind of this, he tried to kill Jeroboam, who then fled to Egypt under Pharaoh's protection until Solomon's death. And you can read about that in 1 Kings 11. But after Solomon's death, and I'd like you to turn over to 1 Kings 12. After Solomon's death, Jeroboam returned and led the northern tribes in revolt against Solomon's son Rehoboam. So Jeroboam then became king of the northern tribes. So here he is, he's the king. But he got concerned. He got concerned about the people in the northern tribes going down to Jerusalem to keep the feasts, as they typically did. And he thought, well, they're going to get, you know, roped back in under Judah. And what can I do about that? So let's look at what it says here in 1 Kings 12. 1 Kings 12, verses 25 through 33. Then Jeroboam built Shechem in the mountains of Ephraim, and he dwelt there. Next verse. And Jeroboam said in his heart, now the kingdom may return to the house of David. If these people go up to offer sacrifices in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, then the heart of this people will turn back to their Lord, Rehoboam, king of Judah, and they will kill me and go back to Rehoboam, king of Judah. Therefore the king asked advice. He made two calves of gold. Well, that's a good move. Already big, big bad thing, you know, hearkening back to the golden calf at the time of the Exodus. But he made two calves of gold and said to his people, it's too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. That's too much trouble for that. Here are your gods, O Israel, which brought you up from the land of Egypt. And he set and he set one up in Bethel, and the other he put in Dan. Now, by the way, it says gods there, but that's Elohim, really. And I believe he's just saying this is God, like this is the, what they normally considered as God, even though he represented as a calf, just like it happened in the wilderness. Now this thing became a sin, verse 34. The people went to worship before the one as far as Dan. He made shrines on the high places and made priests from every class of people who were not the sons of Levi. So, you know, he's just doing all of these bad things. Their own worship place, their own priests, and their own worship days. Jeroboam, that's what we see in verse 32, ordained a feast on the 15th day of the 8th month, instead of the 15th day of the 7th month, which is Tabernacles. But he ordained a feast on the 15th day of the 8th month, like the feast that was in Judah, and offered sacrifices on the altar. So he did at Bethel, sacrificing to the calves that he'd made. And at Bethel, he installed the priests of the high places which he'd made. So he made offerings on the altar which he had made at Bethel on the 15th day of the 8th month, instead of the 7th, in the month which he had devised in his own heart. And he ordained a feast for the children of Israel and offered sacrifice on the altar and burned incense. This was a horrible thing that he did. And so basically what he did is he moved Tabernacles to a month later. But we think, well, how do you successfully do that? I'm not sure. What I actually think he did was more deceptive than what we just read. My guess is part of the way he accomplished this was by declaring, you know, because sometimes you add an intercalary month to where you actually move the months a month later. And my guess is when it wasn't time to add an intercalary month, that was probably the argument. We can move it all a month later and all of a sudden we have a different calendar, even though it's all the same, but we're a month off from the guys down in Jerusalem. And so we just go along. And what you end up, by the way, when you do that, is that the new year starts not at trumpets, but a month later. And then instead of having the Passover and unleavened bread, when it happens, the beginning of the sacred year happens not in March or not in March, April, but April, May. See, it pushes everything. Then you get these things happening all a month later. So that would explain maybe where you get this idea of the Beltane, May 1st, and Samhain at November 1st. That you've moved everything a month off. It's also possible that Jeroboam brought in not just Egyptian false worship, because he probably did that, but also perhaps introduced Egyptian timekeeping. This would have meant the rejection of the Hebrew lunisolar calendar and adoption of the always 12-month solar calendar. This would have fixed the beginning of the sacred year on May 1st and the beginning of the civil year on November 1st. That could well have happened. Jeroboam's false system persisted throughout the 200 years of the Northern Kingdom. I mean, you just read several places, and they continued in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin. That's the big thing. It keeps saying that over and over for all these kings. In reading about the various rulers of the Bible, it often states they did not depart from that. But notice this one, an interesting one in this regard. Turn over to 1 Kings 16, verses 25. And 26, it's talking about Omri. Omri did evil in the eyes of the Lord and did worse than all who were before him. For he walked in all the ways of Jeroboam the son of Nebat, and in his sin by which he had made Israel sin, provoking the Lord God of Israel to anger with their idols. And skipping down to verse 29, read 29 through 33 here, in the 38th year of Asa, king of Judah, Ahab, the son of Omri, became king over Israel. So this is after Omri's dead, Ahab's now king. And Ahab, the son of Omri, reigned over Israel in Samaria 22 years. Now Ahab, the son of Omri, did evil in the sight of the Lord more than all who were before him. And it came to pass, as though it had been a trivial thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, it's not a trivial thing, that he took his wife Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians, and he went and served Baal and worshipped him. So it's even worse. Then he set up an altar for Baal in the temple of Baal, which he had built in Samaria. And Ahab made a wooden image. Ahab did more to provoke the Lord God of Israel to anger than all the kings of Israel who were before him. And we can see this also over in 1 Kings 22, look over several chapters. 1 Kings 22, verses 51 through 53, Ahaziah, the son of Ahab, became king over Israel and Samaria. Skip down to verse 52. He did evil in the sight of the Lord, and he walked in the way of his father, in the way of his mother, and in the way of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who had made Israel sin. For he served Baal and worshipped him and provoked the Lord God of Israel to anger according to all that his father had done. So this just kept going. So you had Baal introduced into this worship system. And of course, later we see this name of Baal in the Celtic Beltane. That's where you get the Beltane. This is Baal was also identified with Molech, by the way, to whom children are passed through the fire. And this may be the origin of Samhain being a festival of fire and death. And also among the Aryans, among whom the Israelites later lived in captivity, the name of the Lord of Death, the Grim Reaper, was Samana. Samas, or Shamash, was the Assyrian name for the sun god. And there's probably some relation here too, as it was the Assyrians who took the Israelites captive. Anyway, all this stuff ends up being combined into what came down to us, the Samhain, and now Halloween. And there's probably a corrupted link to the Feast of Trumpets. Again, what trumpets symbolize, we know, was the resurrection. And actually, that was understood among the people in ancient Israel, even. Some of them had trumpets, shofar, on their graves, because they believed they would rise with the trumpet. Well, again, quoting back again from the Good News article, the Celts believed that the dead ones rose on the eve of Samhain. But of course, that's different from our concept of the resurrection. But they're seeing the dead rising on that day. The Jews also refer to trumpets as the Day of Remembrance, since it is called in Scripture a memorial. You should have a memorial of blowing of trumpets. And they use it as a time to remember dead relatives, which is fitting because it does, you know, remind us of the resurrection. But how interesting in that light, we have this, another Wiccan website says this. Samhain, October 31st, most often recognized as our new year, is also called Ancestor Night. It represented the final harvest. As the veil between the worlds of life and death is thin on this night, we take this time to remember our beloved dead. And so you see the corruption of the truth a little bit in some of these. This, of course, is not at all fitting because it's the wrong day. The concept of the afterlife is totally wrong. It's blended with all manner of pagan worship customs, and it honors outright evil and death. We are not to embrace such customs, but must reject them utterly. So you probably have all the fall festivals eventually rolled into this one celebration among the Israelites. And what did God think about that? Well, I'm going to wrap this up here. I'd like you to turn to 2 Kings 17. And as you do, I'm going to just mention a few scriptures here to think about. Number one is Revelation 18:4. God says, "Come out of her, my people, lest you be partake of her plagues." That this whole system of Babylon. And this is part of the whole system of Babylon. And what I find also interesting is in Revelation 17, you have Babylon portrayed as a false church, a false religion. In Revelation 18, you have Babylon portrayed as this whole economic system. But isn't it interesting that this economic system rests on these pagan holidays? It's still remarkable to think about. The whole greeting card industry is based on these days. If you walk into Walmart, you'll know what I'm talking about. not just the cards. Everything there is all about selling this holiday, a pagan Halloween and then Christmas. It's the same thing. That's the biggest marketing thing of all. It's all tied together, not just the religion, but the marketing, and we are just to come out of that. What do we do with works of darkness? You know, we're told in Ephesians 5, 8 through 11. I'm just going to quote this. For you were once darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Walk as children of light, finding out what is acceptable to the Lord, and have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather expose them. Again, that's Ephesians 5, 8 through 11. That's what our attitude should be about that. And of course, we've already seen that we should be thinking about good things and not dark things. 2 Corinthians 6, 14 and 15. I'll just quote for you that. 2 Corinthians 6, 14, 15. Do not be unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what fellowship has righteousness with lawlessness? And what communion? Think about this. What communion has light with darkness? Why are we to revel in darkness? We are to have no communion with that. And what accord has Christ with Belial? With the devil? With evil? Or what part has a believer with an unbeliever? We're not to participate with them and run with them in these evil things. 1 John 3:8 says, for this purpose the Son of God was manifested, that he might destroy the works of the devil. We're not to revel in the works of the devil. And of course, we've seen already from 1 Corinthians 10 that we're not to partake of the table of demons and the Lord's table. We cannot do that. And, I found this very interesting. I never had noticed this before. Actually, I'll just read this to you and you can think about this. This is in Acts 19, 18 through 19. But somebody was asking the question, well, what did early Christians do with occultic books? And I was thinking, I don't remember anything like that. And it says, what it says in Acts 19, 18 through 19, it says, and many who had believed came confessing and telling their deeds, and also many of those who had practiced magic brought their books together and burned them in the sight of all, and they counted up the value of them, and it totaled 50,000 pieces of silver. So I thought that was very interesting. They came and burned all their magic and occult books, because they just wanted to be totally, have this garbage eradicated from their lives. I thought that's very interesting. For some reason, I've never noticed that verse before, but when it was put in this light, it was very interesting to see that. But finally, like I said, here in 2 Kings 17, you know, Israel was eventually taken into captivity. God had had enough of the northern kingdom. And let's see what happened in 2 Kings 17, verses 20 through 23. It says here in 2 Kings 17, verse 20, verse 20, and the Lord rejected all the descendants of Israel, afflicted them, and delivered them into the hand of plunderers until he had cast them from his sight. That's what happened to them. But why? For, verse 21, he tore Israel from the house of David, and they made Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, king. Then Jeroboam drove Israel from following the Lord and made them commit a great sin. For the children of Israel walked in all the sins of Jeroboam, which he did. They did not depart from them until the Lord removed Israel out of his sight, as he had said by all his servants, the prophets. So Israel was carried away from their own land to Assyria, as it is to this day. And even to this day, brethren, Israel still persists in Jeroboam's rebellion, along with a host of other pagan customs they've picked up over the centuries. May God speed the day of Jesus Christ's return and reign, as represented by the Feast of Trumpets and Tabernacles, that the world may come to see the error in human tradition and the wonderful truth that his true festivals proclaim.